Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Welcome to the Creep Dive.
Welcome to the Creep Dive. Come and have a look. Everybody's listening. Don't open a book.
Don't question us.
Just go with it.
Just go with it. Enjoy it. Don't let the truth get in the way of a good time.
Correct.
Like all the people who are like, sorry, the Amsterdam thing didn't happen. It's like... It's still plausible.
I know. Still could. Just let us have it.
We need
so
it.
So mean. So how are we and what are we packing for today?
I'm going to tell you a little bit of gay history.
Love my favorite thing to do. Gay history story time. Mm. Absolutely love it.
I have a horrendous story that is truly hard to believe about a kidnapping.
Oh. Oh, okay. Well, Jen spoke for... an hour straight on the Hive. So if you want that, that's already out there.
Do you want to kick us off?
I'll tell you a little bit about the fascinating history of the mafia in New York and how pivotal they were in gay rights.
This is interesting.
It's super interesting. It's a very unlikely partnership. So let's go back to New York LGBT community in the 1960s. So for LGBT people in 1960s America, shy time, really bad time. They were on the outskirts of society and they were absolutely shunned, criminalized by the broader culture. So LGBT people were eager for anywhere they could find safety and community and be together. Going to a bar was just a dangerous idea. It was at the time, in the 1960s, still illegal to serve gay patrons alcohol. It was illegal to display homosexuality in public. And it was super illegal for two gay people to dance together.
God.
So.
That's because they'd be such good dancers.
They are such good dancers. So it was under this guise of New York State's liquor laws that barred disorderly conduct in premises. So anything... anything close to homosexuality was... Do you want to make more noise there?
Am I not far away from
the microphone? Like you're close to everyone else's mics. Sorry.
Just have a little
ruffle there now.
This is the cinema in the back. Packet of Crips. Package of Crips.
I wouldn't say you can hear that at all.
This is me trying to eat a Golden Crisp in bed last night while Seb was sleeping and him just giving out so much about the
No, no masticating on mic.
Yeah, keep the... You're okay, you're very good. Mic's down. Everyone's getting relaxed for gay story time. So, a difficult place to be, but one group of people saw it as an opportunity. And that group of people were the Mafia. And in particular, the Genovese family. So...
Would this be like the cake? Genoese.
Is it Gen... Genovese, G-E-N-O-V-E-S-E.
Yep.
Genovese?
Genovese.
Like Kitty Genovese?
Hmm. Sorry, I'm stuck on that now. And
Vito Genovese would have been like the head of this mob family. We call him, you know, Vito, that's easy.
Vito's a baller name, isn't it?
Like, we don't get enough Vitos these days. So... Since the days of prohibition in America, when alcohol was obviously banned, the mob controlled a lot of the nightclubs and a lot of the social places. And they would do so by paying off the local authorities. So a member of the Genovese family, Tony, a.k.a. Fat Tony, Fat Tony saw the treatment of LGBT people as an opportunity. So he went in and he purchased the Stonewall Inn in 1966 and turned it from a little family bar and restaurant, did a very cheap flip on it and opened it as the Stonewall, which we know was like one of the most influential spaces for LGBT rights in the 60s. So it was run on the cheap. It was dangerous, it was dirty, but it was where the gays went to be together. There was no running water. Glasses were cleaned by dipping them in buckets of dirty water.
Uh-oh.
The toilets regularly overflowed. There was no fire or emergency exits, but it was still a place for people to go. And so it became a very popular destination in the gay community, something of an institution. It was the only place where gay people were allowed to go and dance openly, close together. Mm-hmm. And for relatively little money, drag queens were able to perform. It was a place where runaways, homeless LGBT youth and others were able to be kept off the street. It also had a BYOB policy because they were operating outside of these serving alcohol to gays legislation. So for like a little bit of money, you could go and you could be safe in dingy conditions, but be with your people. And Fat Tony paid about $1,200 a week to the police in agreement that they would turn a blind eye to the indecent conduct occurring there behind the closed doors.
What was Fat Tony's plan here?
Well, Fat Tony was profiting off it. Fat Tony ran the bar, owned the bar, was making a shit ton of money off it. It was the only place where the gays could really go.
And so it was bring your own booze and there was an entry fee.
Kind of bring your own booze. There was an entry fee. There was stuff. You could buy a drink in there. The drink was watered down an awful lot, apparently. Like he wasn't putting money into the maintenance. He wasn't like...
It was a shithole.
Wasn't sprucing the place up. Yeah, it was an absolute shithole. So it was one of the most significant places because... Within this agreement of the Mafia owning the bars and paying off the precinct, if there ever were raids on LGBT establishments, which there were all the time, a cop would generally give them a call and let them know. And that's when they would clear off all the alcohol, because like, that was one of the biggest offences, was serving alcohol to homosexuals. So they could clear off all the alcohol. They could get rid of whatever else was going on. It was the 60s. There's going to be loads of
stuff going on.
They can move the drag queens out and all that kind of stuff. And they generally had like a heads up. So raids were just a normal part. They occurred from early in the afternoon when few customers were present. Mm. So businesses had time to resume normal operations at night. During a typical raid, the bar owners would change the lights from blue to white and warn customers to stop dancing, stop drinking. Mm. Patrons then were often lined up and required to show identification. If they didn't have any, they could be arrested. So men were hauled in and arrested for dressing in drag. Women were arrested for wearing less than three pieces of traditional feminine clothing.
Whoa.
Oh,
yeah. Sometimes the police would even send women into female officers into the bathroom with women, drag queens, or transgender people to try and verify their genders. Just like a horrible place all around. So because of these laws and prohibition against serving alcohol to LGBT patrons, in many of the gay bars that there were operated as these bottle bars, private clubs where members could bring their own alcohol. But patrons meant that because they were private clubs, patrons had to sign a membership book. But most people had to put down fake names because they were terrified all the time. So, will I tell you, like, you know the history of Stonewall and what happened? No.
The Stonewall riots.
The Stonewall riots.
Yeah, okay. Tell us.
Let me just get into it.
I don't know this.
I can't believe we've actually never done them.
Yeah, amazed.
So the Stonewall riots became one of the most significant moments of LGBT history. So they were a series of protests by members of the LGBT community in response to a police raid. So one night in the early hours of the 28th of June, 1969, the police raided Stonewall. And this time they didn't get a heads up from a bent copper or like someone on the inside who'd been paid off. So patrons were violently brought out onto the street and they were just treated appallingly. So you had like drag queens performing, you had butch lesbians, as they were like significant. And the butch lesbians, which is the story that I do want to tell you about, are the ones who started working with the mafia, because the mafia weren't threatened by, there's a great thesis that I've been reading about this. So the mafia weren't put off. The mafia didn't, it's not that they liked gay people. They saw it as an opportunity to earn money. Mm. But when it came to the butch lesbians, they behaved in a like patriarchal way, and they really valued what the mafia represented at the head of the family and manliness and stuff. Okay. And the mafia warmed the butch lesbians because they upheld those traditions.
Gotcha.
So they weren't threatened by them. What a funny. And they saw them as like this great in. And also the butch lesbians were really interested in earning a lot of money, and they did that by working with the mafia. So it kind of was this mutually beneficial relationship that they developed together. So back to the Stonewall riots, right? The idea of raiding bars was totally normal at the time, yada, yada, yada. It was just par for the course, I guess, of like going to an LGBT place. So the police raid started early. Two undercover policemen and two undercover policewomen entered the bar that evening to gather visual evidence. As the public morals squad waited outside for a signal. Once ready, the undercover officers called for backup from the 6th precinct using the bar's pay telephone. Stonewall employees do not recall being tipped off that the raid was to occur that night, as was the custom that they had with the mafia and the arrangement of paying off the police. So there was a rumour that one might happen, but since it was much later than raids generally took place, they kind of relaxed into the evening. So it was 1:20 a.m. on Saturday, June 28th. The four plainclothes policemen in dark suits, two patrol officers in uniform, Detective Charles Smith and Deputy Inspector Seymour Pine, arrived at the Stonewall Inn's double doors and announced police were taking the place. Music was turned off. The main lights were turned on. 205 people were in the bar that night. Patrons who had never experienced a police raid were confused, and few realized what was happening and began to run for the doors and windows in the bathrooms. But police barred the doors. So the raid did not go as planned. Standard procedure was to line up the patrons, check their identification, and have female officers take customers dressed as women into the bathroom to verify their sex, upon which any people appearing to be physically male and dressed as women would be arrested. Those dressed as women that night refused to go with the officers. Men in line began to refuse to produce their identification. So people started fighting back against the raid. The police then decided to take everyone present to the police station after separating those suspected of you know, being transgender in a room in the back of the bar. So all parties involved recalling this sense of discomfort spread very quickly.
God.
Started the way the police who assault started assaulting some of them. They physically assaulted a lot of women and began feeling up women inappropriately when they were frisking them. So 28 cases of beer and 19 bottles of hard liquor were seized. It was just a raid that kind of got out of hand, but then it moved to getting violent very quickly. So the police tried to restrain some of the crowd, knocking a few people down, which incited bystanders even more. Some of those handcuffed who were getting carted away in the police wagons were moved away and they were fine. But the crowd started to try and overturn the police wagon. Two police cars and a wagon had their tires slashed. And it basically just erupted into like this them versus us mentality of the police against the LGBT people. So what happened in the days that followed, I think I'm correct in saying nobody was killed during the Stonewall riots, but it just, there was a lot of violence and a lot of disease. And because the police had behaved in a certain way, the patrons started rioting, like protesting outside the Stonewall Inn. And it became, it's often heralded as like the beginnings of pride protests, where instead of just like fearing it and moving away, that for the first time they came together and stood their ground outside
and to
the
publicly out themselves.
Yes, so they
well.
they were publicly outing themselves, and there was this, it's just considered this really like watershed moment for LGBT rights, where they would stand up and go against it. And yeah, there was like a couple of very significant activists like Marsha P. Johnson, who became very well known in the gay liberation movement, who would have been there during Stonewall at the time, and a couple of the other kind of top organizers, a lot of trans organizations coming from it, and just a fucking great time. Well, a horrible time, but like a great legacy to come from the Stonewall riots. So that's the kind of vague history of the Stonewall riots and this Stonewall being owned by the mafia. So I have one little fun story. So because I was saying to you, like the mafia, they're notoriously macho, you know.
Yeah. In the traditional sense.
Yeah. Killings. Macho, misogynistic, like. Traditionally, women don't, they have, you know, the mob wives, but they don't necessarily participate in the mafia and all that kind of stuff. But there is one story of a transgender woman called Terry. And she actually ended up forming a very close personal relationship with Anna Genovese, who was the wife of one of the mafia bosses. And this is just a cutesy little tale. So Terry is a transgender woman, and she tried to force herself into acting like a gay man her entire life, but she knew she was not sexually attracted to men. So kind of knew that there was, I guess, knowing that she felt differently before transitioning, thought maybe she was a gay man, knew that she was part of this community of people that were alternative and queer and whatever else, but it never found her, I guess, what, fit for her. So she knew she was not sexually attracted to men, and she was performing at one of the other clubs, the 82 club, for a period of time, made peace with herself and gathered up enough courage to start transitioning. So she, as an LGBT person in the 60s, was on the edge of financial destitution. Drag queens could not afford anything outside of their normal expenses, let alone medical procedures of that kind of nature. So unintentionally, Terry ended up befriending Anna and telling her about her situation, to which the mafia boss, and she was the owner of 82 Club, responded by sending her to her personal physician. So over the course of 18 months, a doctor in Brooklyn examined and treated Terry with one weekly shot. He prescribed her with daily pills. The doctor's office never billed Terry. After 2 years of attending visits and a year and a half of receiving hormones, the doctor, through frequent installments from Anna, arranged for Terry's surgery.
Wow.
So during that time, like, they would have used language like self-mutilation to describe transitioning, and they would describe it as medically unethical and immoral. But regardless of all that criticism, Terry went through the procedures to live the life she had always wanted, and it would have been impossible without Anna's monetary and emotional support. So
Incredible.
Yeah. Anna received a lot of criticism as well, because like she obviously did it from a place of, I don't know, empathy or friendship. But she then herself was constantly berated for her closeness to the LGBT community. And there was suspicion that Anna herself was identified as a lesbian, but she was one of the good ones.
Was Anna publicly hanging out with Terry?
Like, well, Terry worked as a drag performer in the bar.
Okay.
So they would have, yeah, they would have had like a very obvious relationship, but it could have been not a relationship, but like a working relationship. Gotcha. So they definitely knew each other, and that was all fine. I did find a little bit more on Anna.
And it started
later
to become, people were like, why is Anna so involved in this?
Yeah.
And is Anna gay?
Yeah. I mean, of course, that's where they go, because it's like, you like the gays, you must be gay. But of course, it could have been just that she
was a nice and decent person.
An ally. Mm-hmm. A nice person. Let me find a little, I think.
What was Terry's surname?
I don't have Terry's surname, because a lot of the people in this. So this thesis all about gay rights in 90s, 60s New York. It is written from, it's, there's an author who wrote a fictionalized book about it. Mm. And she befriended, she's a gay woman, and she befriended a lot of these people in kind of the 80s and 90s. And they wanted to still, I mean, the fear persists. They wanted to remain, they wanted to remain anonymous. But it's absolutely fascinating. Let me
the
just.
Glamour of Anna Genovese. She is sensational. Look over there. Mink lined evening wear. Heavy mock hard hair.
So there's a podcast called Mob Queens, hosted by two people called Bendinger and Seligman, and they interviewed Anna's granddaughter Mia about just her involvement and all this kind of stuff. And Mia, without prompting, started mentioning Anna's romantic involvement with a woman named Jackie who lived at the Hotel Arlington. So when Anna went to visit Jackie, the latter left her grandchildren in the park across the street to play, so they were never allowed to go upstairs and see Jackie. But at the age of 21, Mia met Jackie for the first time at her grandmother's funeral, where she discovered Anna's had this secret after all this time. So she confirmed that her grandmother had had another affair with Gwen Saunders, a cashier at one of the nightclubs. So aside from her mafia status, the Italian-American businesswoman brought an invaluable personal connection to the queer patrons and performers who entered Club 82 and the other bars that she helped run. Mia said she wasn't certain of Anna's sexuality, but it seems apparent from the interviews with drag queens and drag kings that she had had extramarital relationships with women.
Good God.
Good for her.
Good honor.
Good for her. What an absolute mad connection. But of course, you can sort of see how that would have been the case with the mob.
They're operating outside of the mainstream as well.
Exactly. Yeah.
So the gay people were forced to.
This is what they say about the butch lesbians. So they loved drag kings and butch lesbians because they recognized that they had a basic understanding of money. They were not getting swept up in the fight for equal rights, especially the freedom of expression, because they didn't want to, draw attention to themselves. And they knew that going with the mafia would bring them financial success and protective services as well. So the women, the drag kings in particular, acted with this sort of macho nature. They did not pose a threat to the proud Italian men who viewed drag queens as fairies. And they appreciated the American man's mission of reaching middle class. So, yeah, the gay male entertainers gained several enemies in the mafia, the NYPD, and the politically moderate queer organizations. But the drag kings and the butch lesbians kind of used the views of society to their advantage, you know, and made their dime. got their protection, had a great time.
Yeah. And amazing. Advanced the movement. The rights.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, they did to an extent, but it cannot be undermined. Like, it must be appreciated that the people at the forefront of the Stonewall riots were generally trans.
Sorry.
No. But like, in particular as well, like,
the mafia saved the gays.
In particular, the Stonewall riots. The Stonewall riots were
a pivotal moment in.
Yeah, but they were really, it was gay men and transgender people. It was a lot of transgender people predominantly who were at the forefront of the Stonewall riots.
Amazing.
I mean, there's probably more lesbians who've been written out of history because that's what we did. And just ignored the fact that women existed in the past at all.
Yes, absolutely.
Especially gay women. But there you have it.
Well, thank you.
You had a bit of gay history.
Love a gay history, creep. The more you know.
It's kind of uplifting, and now I'm bringing us right down.
Uh-oh. Where are we going?
Okay. We're going to the 70s, so just a couple of years later. And we are going to the Americas.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to a place that is very hard to get right in pronunciation, but I will try. Pocatello, Idaho.
Pocatello.
Okay. So let me introduce you to the Brobergs. Siren, rude. They were a very close family of Bob and Marianne, and their three daughters, the oldest of whom was called Jan. And they were members of the Church of Latter-day Saints.
Of course.
And they are, that church is also, of course, known as the Mormon Church. And they lived in this totally, by all accounts, idyllic community in Pocatello. They were your total nuclear, like American nuclear family. Bob, the dad, ran a florist in the town, and Marianne was at home with the kids. And
lovely.
And they were like, there seems to be just this kind of innocence about them, this kind of like earnestness about them. The daughter Jan said later that like they had a kind of an almost family motto that was like, every day's a bonus. And they
they're grateful.
They were sweet, you know, they were just sweet. And so in the early 70s, Jan the oldest was 9. When Bob and Marianne became friends with another family, who were the Birchtolds. So we had Birchtolds and Brobergs. And also the head of the Birchtolds was also called Bob. So from here on out, we will call Bob, Jan's dad, Bob. And we're going to call the Birchtold dad, B.
Okay.
And so the Birchtolds had a rake of boys, little boy kids. And there was almost kind of like, you know, a sort of a corresponding kid for each of the Broberg kids to be friends with in the Birchtold family.
So we're so talking like, about the American TV show called
The Brady Bunch.
The Brady Bunch, kind of.
But without the blending of the family.
I see. There's still one wife. Yes, carry on.
Yeah. So there's like, and so like B's wife, Gail, you know, they were married and they were in the church as well. And they moved to Pocatello in the early 70s. And the two families just like became really, really close. They were kind of always in each other's houses. They went on trips together, picnics, the works. And the parents were great friends, really close. And like I said, in this kind of community in the early 70s, like it was just like such a safe place. Like Jan, the eldest daughter, describes how like they would all just like leave their houses at the beginning of the day, get on their bikes, go and buy sweets, go to the park.
Talk to strangers.
Bike rides together. And then, you know, everyone left their doors open. It was all that kind of usual thing. And
were they very close, as in close neighbors?
Like, as in
swingers
live? Oh, do you mean that?
Physically close?
No, they did. Yeah, they lived a few. They lived just down the block. Gotcha. Like, they'd moved in just down the block. And B, the patriarch of the other family, were like, he was like a local businessman as well. So they had all this in common. And like, Bob Broberg, Jan's dad, who was the florist, was like particularly known for just like being a big softie. And like, if anyone ever was like getting flowers for a funeral or a wedding, like, he was always like really, really generous, like almost to a fault. I think his business wasn't like wildly successful, but it was because he
such a nice
just
guy.
Loved people and wanted to help people. And so one day in 1974, it was October, and B came round to Bob and Marianne's house to pick up Jan, the eldest, to take her to horseback riding. And Marianne was like, oh, she's got piano lessons. And B was like, ah, no problems, I'll get her after the piano lessons. That's all grand.
Yeah.
And so B picked up Jan, who was 12, and Jan had been taken for like allergy testing. All of the kids had, actually, at B's behest. So B was like to Bob and Marianne, he was like, oh, my lads are getting allergy testing. Like, let's, you want your kids to row in on this as well. And so like, Jan got into the car with B and
alone?
He, yeah, to go horseback riding. And he, like, I cannot state enough how enmeshed the families were.
Yeah, or, yeah, like, this sounds a bit strange for a dad of another family to be taking one daughter.
Yeah.
But I guess that's just the way the cookie crumbled that day.
Yeah, and the kind of innocence of the times. And like, they really, they'd been friends for years at this stage.
Okay. And nothing ever weird beforehand.
Well.
Okay, weird things.
I'll dial back in a minute. But basically, he, when Jan got into the car, was like, oh, don't forget to take your allergy pill, and gave her a quote unquote allergy pill.
Oh, no.
And then the next thing.
And Jan's 9, is she?
She's 12 at this point.
She's 12.
The next thing, Jan woke up in the back of B's motorhome. Like,
where the fuck is the motorhome?
So B, while Jan was passed out, drove to like this sort of storage garage where he kept the motorhome, and switched vehicles and started heading to Mexico.
Jesus. Oh my God. In the motorhome. And Jan's
in the motorhome,
too,
and
the
he
back.
Had tied her to the bed at the back.
Oh my God.
And she was definitely kind of like coming in and out of consciousness. I mean, she was 12 years old. Like, and she loved B. Like,
so her thing was, who's taking
us? He was
us?
Like a second dad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you know that kind of way? And so meanwhile, back at the Broberg's house, Marianne and Bob were a bit like, where are they? Like, hours had been going by. There was no sign of them. They'd rang Gail and been like, and do you know where B is? And like, she's supposed to have been back. And she was like, yeah, she hadn't seen him. This is a strange one, but I do think it probably speaks to the kind of insular world of a church like the LDS. They didn't raise the alarm with authorities until 4 or 5 days later.
4 or 5 days?
Yeah.
And a 12-year-old is gone. Like, from their perspective, though, well, that's suggestive of they knew they were alive. That's a guilty. That's a suggestion of guilt there, because if they thought they were in an accident, which is what a normal person in a normal situation would believe, they were in a car accident. Where's the crash? You're ringing the police immediately.
Yeah, I think that they knew B to be like such a good person. And he did have a very special
connection
to Jan. And
but even B's wife.
I think they just kept being like, they'll be back. They'll be back any minute. I think that there was like probably a bit of shame about like, they literally handed Jan over you know.
But even Gail.
And also, Gail kept begging them to not just kind of wait.
She fucking knew, yeah.
And
fuck. Because presumably Jan had been over there for sleepovers and all sorts of stuff. So Gail.
Yeah, yeah.
Had. Gail knew.
Well, yeah. Like, prior to this night, there was an incident at Gail and Bea's house. So Jan had come over for a sleepover and all of the kids were sleeping out. I mean, it's so idyllic sounding. Like, they were sleeping out on the trampoline under the stars. Like, cute. This was their sleepover. And at one point in the night, Jan had woken up and kind of like felt a little bit uneasy and noticed that her nightgown, I cannot stress enough how like there's some hard subjects in this story. Sorry, okay. Shouldn't have brought us this deep in.
I could do a flag. Kind of stop now. Give us a trigger warning moment for people.
Child abuse.
Okay.
Grooming.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so Jan had kind of her nightdress twisted. I mean, couldn't have been more than 10 or 11.
Jesus.
And her knickers kind of off. Like down.
Oh, dear.
And she, and B was there. And she kind of went into the house to where Gail was. And she was very close to Gail as well. And she was obviously disturbed and upset and distressed. And B like hurried in after her and was like, oh, you were just wriggling around in your sleep. Oh, I went out there because I thought that you just were having trouble sleeping and you seemed to be having a dream, you know, and tried to kind of fob it off. Mm. And like, so this Gail had been aware of.
Was any of this reported back to Jan's family?
No, not that.
Okay.
And so anyway, as I said, Jan woke up in the back of this motorhome and they were headed to Mexico.
Jesus.
And so...
She was tied.
She was restrained at that point. But the next thing that Jan remembers is a strange kind of audio box, kind of like some kind of radio box, was playing and saying all these strange things about aliens. And the aliens were called Zethro and, oh, what was the other alien's name? Zeta and Zethra.
This is ringing bells.
And she fully believed she had just been abducted. She hadn't seen B yet. So she was lying there with these strange voices playing. And the voices seemed to be kind of saying that, like, she had been chosen for this mission that would save the world. And, all she had to do was become pregnant before the age of 16 and it would head off this disaster, and that she had been chosen for this mission and so had B. And so then she realized B was in the motorhome and he was kind of all sort of scratched up and a bit banged up. And basically why he was banged up was because when he was switching vehicles, he tried to make it look like their car had been attacked,
right,
and that he and Jan might have been abducted or captured. Only, like, definitely very poorly executed. The window of the car was smashed quite clearly from the inside.
Okay.
Things like that. So, like, the Brobergs, like, back in Pocatello, the car had by then been found. Our authorities had become involved. And and there was just no trace of, like, which direction had they gone in, do you know, that kind of way. And, like, they were just still reeling from the shock. It was just like, it was like a really close family friend just suddenly turned on a dime.
Yeah.
Anyway, so back in the motorhome, he begins to, like, abuse Jan under the kind of pretext of
world.
We have to do this, and if you don't become pregnant by the time you're 16, the world will end and your family will be destroyed and you yourself will be vaporized. And, like, this just being presented to Jan by, like, a really trusted person. Like, she just didn't question it remotely, and she was 12 years old. Gosh. And so basically they got to Mexico and he married her in Mexico,
which was legal there.
Yes, to marry a child of 12. Wow. At the time in the 70s. And so he then contacted his brother, and this was the first kind of contact he made back with anyone in the States. And he said to his brother, I want you to go to Bob and Marianne and tell them that I will come back to the state, come up back to the States, come home, as long as they agree to give permission for him to legally marry Jan under US law. And they were like, no.
Bob.
Yeah. And obviously really distressed.
But also and then grateful. In the end, did they know at that point the families, like, were they aware that B had abducted Jan now? Had
yeah. the case. Yeah, so they'd stopped.
Yeah, they'd stopped like, believing that they'd been accident. Abducted.
Yeah, and now there was this issue of him like really openly wanting to marry their 12-year-old child.
But on one hand, glad that she's alive.
Obviously, yeah, definitely.
But also, holy shit.
And so then Joe, the brother, was like, I'm not having this. It's funny, like, Joe's involvement, like, he seems to, like, definitely have love for his brother B. But, and he knows that B had, like, a rough childhood, things like that. But he is the one who contacted authorities and told them where they were in Mexico. And there was, like, a raid on the motorhome, terrifying for Jan. They were brought to a prison and kept separate. And, like, B in the prison bribed a guard to go and get Jan so that they could have a conversation. And B said to Jan, you cannot tell anyone about the mission. If you tell anyone about the mission, your family will die. You will be vaporized. You know, he just immediately was like, she's on lockdown.
Yeah.
She won't tell anyone what's happened.
Yeah. Poor Jan.
And so they were like, you know, basically like Jan was returned to her family, and B was like turned over to the authorities in the US, and they
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We're all set to like press charges for him kidnapping.
Yeah, obviously.
Jan. When suddenly Bob and Marianne were like, we're not going to testify. We're not going to admit to any of this.
Wow.
Yes.
So, wow.
Things totally was that bizarrely.
Do you think that was to do with like the being LDS, that they didn't want to, like, it was a religious thing that they didn't want to bring attention, or do you think it was they were like, this has all been a misunderstanding?
Well, what was happening at this point was that Marianne and Bob both had secrets, and particularly under pressure from B and Gail.
B and Gail knew their secrets?
They did. And they both put it back on Marianne and Bob. If you do this, if you press charges,
we will out you.
Will all come out.
What were their secrets?
And also, Marianne and Bob, like, seemingly really didn't believe that Jan had been physically or sexually abused.
Okay.
Jan was maintaining she hadn't been.
Okay.
But B obviously was. So I'll just dial back a tiny bit. 2 years earlier, Obviously, the families are really close.
Mm.
B had kind of particularly always like really flattered Marianne. They'd be in church and he'd be like, oh, I love like your sense of style. And I'd love if you like helped Gail, you know, a little bit with like picking out clothes and things, you know. I sure know she'd love to look as good as you, Marianne.
But B is on the ultimate groom. Mm. Like he's grooming everyone in the family at this point.
Exactly. He's a complete, like consummate predator who knows that if he can get to every member in this family and create distance and divide within the family,
whatever he wants,
he will have total control. So he said to, you know, Marianne, he flattered her constantly. And there definitely seems to have been times where Marianne has kind of later said things went, you know, a little bit far. Like I heard her describe like there was necking.
Okay.
Like it's still the innocence. Yeah. Like I know I can't help but feel for everyone involved in the story. Not B obviously, but like Marianne and Bob. That there had been necking and a bit of inappropriate touching and things like that.
Interesting.
And then... B was also very kind of handy around the house, and all the little girls slept down in stairs in this kind of big room. And he was like, oh God, like they're getting too old to be sharing this big room. I'll put up a wall for you guys. And he literally, now this is, remember, 2 years before the kidnapping, like erected partition walls in the little girl's room downstairs so that Jan had a room on her own. So then the next thing B kind of came out with was that he suffered depression as a result of events in his childhood. And he was seeing a psychotherapist who had recommended this very particular type of treatment. So B, when he was growing up, he'd kind of grown up kind of rural, and his dad particularly kind of ostracized him from the family in the main and had him sleep out in a kind of a barn on the land from a very young age. And he, the only time B could ever really like come inside the family home was if he was taking care of his little sister. And so B told Bob and Marianne that the psychologist had recommended that, like, in his past, the only time that he had felt kind of like a part of a family and kind of accepted was when he was taking care of this little girl. And that the psychiatrist recommended that he sleep beside a little girl. And
fucking hell.
That is not, that's just not
now,
true.
Even if we take into
account. Now, you will be shocked to hear that psychologist did not have a license.
But
that came out later.
I'm shocked to even hear that there was a psychologist.
I know. But there was apparently these audio tapes that the psychologist had made that B was to listen to while he lay down beside the little girl. And so he came to Marianne and Bob and was like, I have this illness. This is the treatment recommended. Can I lie down with Jan while I listen to my therapy tapes?
What were on the tapes? The therapist talking to
something
him.
Like that. Yeah.
And, can I lie down with Jan in the small cubby hole I've created for her in my basement? No.
In their basement, yeah.
Oh, in their basement.
Ground floor.
So he's asked. So, sorry, this is in their home. They're upstairs in bed.
So Marianne describes how. So they agreed. They were like.
The grooming this man must have done to that family. The slowly, slowly, carefully pushing it a little further each and every time.
Mm.
They are victims in this, but
oh yeah, yeah. But it is
still beggars belief. It's still, even the naivety, even taking into account the times, it's still amazing that they allowed this to carry on.
Totally bizarre. So, but remember, he's like started to sow the seeds of having something on them. But like Marianne says that like it's the scene that she has described is like the door be kind of open. He'd be in there kind of lying on the bed and she'd be kind of pottering. You know, Jan after the kids' bedtime, pottering, doing laundry, stuff like that. You know, and then, but there is definitely, there's suggestion that like at other times, you know, that door would be closed, but it would all then become normalized for them in some strange way. And then obviously it was kind of legitimized by the fact that it was like, oh, this is the treatment that my doctor has prescribed.
But the shit that he had on her,
Marianne,
necking.
Yeah, but like this was such a kind of a cloistered community. There was such, and like, you know, the way in like LDS, there's like this really, really intense hierarchy within the church where like, if you want to do, if you do something or you want to do something in your life that may in some way like be slightly against LDS teachings or something like that.
Yeah.
You like take it to a higher up and you seek their advice. You either get permission or you get punished or, you know, that kind of way. So then basically.
Did anyone else know that this was ongoing?
There is no way that Gail did not know.
Sorry, absolutely. Now, Gail knew, but I outside of these two families,
like, no look at all. Gail seems to have literally never ever spoken and disappeared. And I'm like, I don't blame her, but obviously it's very tough. Like, this shit's not on Gail. She knew stuff was going on. This shit is not on Gail, but like, oh,
I think like, of all the guilty parties, Gail has the least blood on her hands here.
I mean, yeah, she's complicit. Obviously, I think you've got B. And then you've got the...
Her parents.
Her parents.
Mm. So, can the I next... Ask
you, you were saying that about the LDS stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when I said, did anyone else know? It was outside of the two families. Would the community...
Elders or anything?
Like, I don't think so. But say, for example, if the Brobergs, Jan's parents, had decided that this was a matter that they needed advice on... They might have taken it to higher ups who might have said, go with it, B's a good man. But I don't know if that took place.
Okay.
I know there's other parts of the story where they did involve higher ups. So basically, this is all going on. This is all like simmering away. B is doing this like, kind of treatment involving Jan. It seems like kind of over the course of like 8 months.
Jan,
like
the sacrificial lamb.
Many kind of times. But again, it's all before the kidnapping. So it's all before he like kind of
this is his big plan.
Yeah. It's all before him telling or him orchestrating this alien narrative, you know. And so one day he comes to Bob out of work or whatever. And he tells Bob that like he's really struggling in his marriage. And he's like, can you go for a drive? Like, I just really need to get some stuff off my chest. And Bob is like, yeah, of course, you know, let's go for a drive. And they kind of, over the course of this afternoon, B tells Bob that, like, he needs sexual release and that, you know, Gail is just not really providing that side of life. And Bob recounts later that he... noticed that B was aroused.
Oh, wow.
And basically Bob
jerked him off.
Yeah.
Jerked him off in the
car. Holy fuck.
Yeah. Oh.
What kind of a fucking guy is B? How is he doing this?
Doing this with everyone, yeah.
Yeah. Like he tells Bob that he had a very traumatic childhood.
He's really hanging a lot of shit on this hook.
He tells Bob that he, at a very, very young age, was assaulted by his aunt.
Mm.
And that this has kind of like messed him up.
Sexually with women. Well, confused him more.
In general.
Yeah, in general. And like Bob just kind of feels like, well, can't say how Bob felt, but like he did this. And so
there's the shit.
All the groundwork has been laid now for B to really put this family through the ringer.
And can I just add, like, the type of people, Jan's parents, would they be especially naive?
Definitely.
Yeah. Would they be sort of vulnerable people in their, you know?
I mean, it seemed to be, like, I mean, financially, they seemed not well off, but comfortable. And they obviously... were kind of upstanding in their community and liked.
They were operating, but like, I think was there that a piece they're kind missing?
Of other friends and things had slightly been edged out by the kind of level of closeness with the Birchtolds.
Okay.
Birchtolds. So anyway.
Fucking hell.
Cut back to 1974. B and Jan have returned.
Okay.
The charges for kidnapping have been dropped.
Okay.
I think that B is kind of advised to get some kind of help, therapeutic help.
Good idea.
But largely things go back to normal-ish. But
post-kidnapping?
Yeah. Like, so B is still involved in their lives post-kidnapping.
And Jan?
Yeah. So he uses a very specific method to like keep Jan ensnared and keep Jan focused on their quote unquote mission. So he does.
So that's why
he's
ringing
the house constantly. And then he starts to get messages to Jan through her classmates in school. So she'd be in class and another student would pass her a note that would be like, go to this payphone at 4 o'clock and to receive your next orders and things like that.
Oh my God.
And, you know, so she would do that. And like the whole time she was like living in fear. Like she was not fear of B at all. She loved him. Like deeply loved him.
Yeah.
She was living in fear of the kind of overarching kind of ticking time bomb of the all of this going shit to is going to hit the fan when I'm 16 if I'm not pregnant by the time I'm 16.
Oh my God.
And
this guy is a fucking monster, isn't he?
He is a fucking monster. And then this is really hard to believe. Marianne entered into a sexual relationship with B.
It's actually not hard to believe.
Okay. Full sex with B.
Yeah.
After everything.
After everything.
Knowing now at this point that he has abused her daughter.
Well, no. Taken her daughter. Returned her. No.
Come on.
I know. I think they believed that there hadn't been abuse.
Well, they
had had
Jan
examined.
Point.
When she was returned from Mexico.
Interesting.
And the doctor found...
Inconclusive.
No, that there didn't seem to be any evidence of sexual assault. Mm-hmm. Like Jan herself later says that like she feels B was extremely careful. Like, I know, absolute bomb.
Puke.
Absolute bomb. So now Marianne and Bob are just like kind of becoming, like coming undone. Like... Bob has this huge burden
He's
of
tortured.
His transgression
yeah.
and feeling so responsible. And then Marianne is like engaged in an you know, active
affair.
Enough affair with B. And then like B tells Bob about the affair. And it
knows that Bob can't do a fucking thing.
Kind of,
because
yeah.
of the hand job.
Yeah. But like Bob then just... goes to their attorney that had represented them when they had been looking for a Jan. You know, they'd gotten an
yeah.
attorney. Goes to him and, like, the attorney's like, you have to divorce her. Like, and, you know, he serves her papers.
Okay,
he takes the little girls out for when she's getting served the papers.
Okay.
And she is just broken by... the idea that they would get a divorce by her actions. Like, it definitely doesn't seem like, it seems like the affair was like extremely fraught for her emotionally.
Yeah.
It seems like she kind of couldn't help herself. Like, I do feel for everything that B has managed to kind of perpetrate, he is, you know, he is some kind of like love bombing, you know, grooming fucking savant. Like that he you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I feel like I'm going easy. Maybe I sound like I'm going too easy on Marianne, but like I don't know, from watching her in interviews and stuff, I'm just like, this is a tortured person.
Yeah.
All of these people were broken by this.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? So then the next thing is
I'm
Bob
stuck on
and
the fucking
Gail
tapes.
Move.
I'm sleeping with it. There's just no way you can move past that.
Oh,
like,
I know.
Like,
yeah,
they are where the book stops.
Oh, 100% they're responsible.
Like, this
yeah.
man perpetrated that. They invited him into their home.
Yeah.
Repeatedly.
And sacrificed their child to him.
So,
and they protected their own reputations over
above
her safety.
Yes, exactly. They are absolutely awful.
It's terrible.
That's very true. I think I've been listening to so much of In Their Own Words that I really do.
You're
just
hearing them.
Huge sympathy here. I'm like, whoa. they were targeted by like a fucking monster who was very fucking good at what he did. So anyway, the next thing is B and Gail, B moves.
Okay.
And he goes to...
alone or with everyone? His family.
With the family, because he goes to take over being in charge of a children's play center.
Fucking hell.
Christ.
And, a few towns over.
We haven't mentioned Gail.
So she is very opaque in all this. Like everything I have found and read and listened to, I cannot get a handle on her at all.
No voice.
Yeah.
No story from
her. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I get it. Like, Jesus, you would just disappear and that'd be that.
Her insight here is really needed.
Oh, I know.
And his own children.
So anyway, the next thing is that his oldest, who is the same age as Jan, is working in the kind of sort of place for the summer. And he immediately starts getting on to Jan and Marianne and Bob, being like, you know, she can come down here and work in the play center place with Jerry, the son. Mm. I think the son's name is Jerry. Anyway, mm-hmm. they're like, no. Like Bob is like, absolutely fucking not over my dead body.
These people are out of our lives.
Yeah. Marianne is like, no, but they're having a situation now with Jan. She's getting a bit older. She is nearly 15 at this stage.
Okay.
In her mind, she is fucking frantic because she's on the mission and she's time is running out.
Oh my God, the mission.
And like the thing is, like he had constantly continued the seeds of the mission through messages and notes. And like there was definitely some times where he like planted the voice box in her room while she was asleep at night. Mm. Fucked up things. And she is desperate to go down there and work for the summer and be with B.
And gets pregnant.
She obviously tells no one about the mission. She's really, really acting out. They're finding it incredibly hard to, you know, keep a handle on the situation and her. And now yeah. I've heard two different accounts of what happens next. I've heard one from Jan and one from a different documentary. So basically, the documentary told it that Marianne eventually relented and bought Jan a plane ticket to go down there and work.
Marianne did.
The mother.
Of course.
And that Bob told her, you're going to regret that to the day you die. The other version that I heard Jan herself give was that she was old enough, she had learned to drive, and that one day when her mother was out, she literally got out a phone book, called herself a taxi, went to the airport and got a flight with money B had gotten to her somehow.
Okay. Well, if Jan said it, presumably that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, she has no need to protect her parents in this.
No, but she was involved in the other documentary as well. So like, I don't think there's lying going on here. I don't know if it's misremembered or whatever.
Okay.
And so basically, one way or another, she ends up in the camp. I think there was another suggestion that B had driven up for her and like she climbed out of her window at night.
Okay.
And he had just parked around the corner from the house with the lights off. Fucking whichever way that cookie crumbled is disturbing.
So she's there anyway.
She's there. Joe, the brother of B, visits them during that time and he's like, I've never seen B so happy. Jesus Christ. Very, very disturbed by what he's witnessing, you know, knows it's wrong and just can't understand why his brother wants this little girl. And like the thing is, Jan at this age still looks really, really young. Not that it would impact what's like the right,
but there's
or wrongness
a very
of this,
clear but something,
like there is definitely, she's spoken about how she still hadn't hit puberty. She's mentioned that a few times, which I think means she hasn't started menstruating yet, which is like another anxiety because she can't get pregnant for her mission. And so basically she stayed down there for 2 weeks and continued the mission. And then she came home after the 2 weeks. But in August of 1976, she disappeared again. Sorry, that was Bob taking her directly from the home.
What age is she
then? Literally in the middle of the night. She's barely 15.
Okay.
Where she is just, she might have just turned 15. So she's very young.
She's gone. Everybody knows where she, I mean.
Yeah. I mean, there's no question about it.
So, like, immediately after she's gone, immediately they're on to Bob. Bob's like, I've no idea. I've no idea where she is. And, but investigators were like, it can only be Bob. So, she was gone for 102 days.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Fucking hell.
And 2.5 months.
They had no idea where she was in the country. And, like, the family is just absolutely crumbling. Disintegrating. Like,
3 months.
Obviously, Bob and Marianne blame themselves.
As they should.
Obviously, they're just devastated and scared. They were also, like, getting this, like, feedback from B that, like, that Jan was kind of on the streets, had turned to sex work. Like, mad shit. And
why would he say that? Don't look for her, or this
she's a lost cause. She's a lost cause.
Yeah, yeah, like that kind of thing. Jesus. And so then the investigators had watched Bob. They were sort of had him under surveillance.
Bob or B?
B, sorry. B. Thank you, B. And they saw him going to a payphone one day and they were like, what's going on? He left. They went into the payphone. This is very like... If this is in a film, you'd be like, ah, oh, yeah, right. But anyway, basically, the phone book was open to a page that had the number of a Catholic girls' boarding school in Pasadena, California.
Mm.
And they were like, "That's she's got to be there. Is. And so when they went to the Catholic boarding school, they were like, we don't have any Jan Broberg here. The authorities were like, she could be under a fake name. Mm-hmm. The nuns were giving nothing away.
Oh, shocking.
Until they finally managed to convince the nuns that they were, you know,
police
authority looking for a kidnapped child.
Exactly.
And the nuns revealed that B had brought Jan to the convent, had said that he was a member of the CIA and that there was very dangerous people who, you know, had it out for him, that his wife had been murdered in the Lebanon. This was their only child.
Jesus Christ.
And that they had to keep her safe, that anyone who came looking for her was trying to get to him and would only harm her. And they had made an alias of Janice Tobler, lazy alias. So
why
she
would
was
be
brought back to
have gone? Why would he have done that? He had
to
limited
keep her
access
somewhere that she no, but as her quote unquote father.
Oh, he had full access every weekend
yeah.
or
whenever
up.
He wanted. Yeah,
and Jan during that time was
still terrified about the mission. Like growing anxiety about like. Would she be able to become pregnant?
And like,
felt
without
responsible
her family.
For her family's safety. Loved B. Like, Jan, the adult, has spoken about how deep this bond was, how completely knit into her this love was. And, you know, he had been grooming her since she was 9, essentially. Like, that's when they all first met, you know? This is an adult that she has, you know, grown. Like, so
suppose,
deeply enmeshed with over the course of 5 years.
Yeah, and the fact that her parents have been like, it's fine.
He's amazing.
He's a great guy.
I'll jerk him off. You do the necking.
Oh, I'm God, I'm so sorry. I don't know. I'm so... You know what? I'll tell you why I have a sense of respect for Bob and Marianne, even though they made huge mistakes at the time. I'll tell you about it in a minute. So basically, her 16th birthday was approaching. They had rescued her from this convent. She was back at home.
She's panicking now.
She's panicking, but also B's contact is becoming less and less.
Oh.
And adult Jan is like, yeah.
I
was getting aged out. And so she had slowly... She was so... Her 16th birthday was approaching and she was so fucking panicked that she had a plan. She said she knew where her father hid his gun and she was going to... B had told her that if she couldn't get pregnant, then he would have to go on to her next youngest sister.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And that if Susan... So she had kind of developed a plan. Like, I mean, she was addled. Nice. Out of her mind, I think, is absolutely fair to say. And she basically decided she was going to ask Susan if she would take her place in the mission. Oh, and if God. Susan said no, Jan was going to hurt Susan and herself. Take their
God.
Lives. And so she went to this like acting camp. She was really into drama. It's so sad because she was so extrovert and like, that's probably why you picked her. You know? Mm. And anyway, she went to this kind of drama camp and she was like petrified because the 16th birthday was approaching. There was a boy at the drama camp who really liked her and like he, I mean, very innocent, like bought her an ice cream and like she was fucking terrified at this, that this would jeopardize the mission. She was doing the wrong thing and the aliens would, you know what I mean? Yeah. Oh, it's just devastating. And she, on the evening of her 16th birthday, called home and like they said, oh, the dogs are a bit out of sorts. And Jan became convinced that this was the beginning of it.
Yeah.
And so she was terrified. She went to sleep on the 16th birthday, woke up the next morning. Her mum rang. She was like, what's coming? And the mum was like, oh, the dogs are grand again. And they must have just had something to eat. And she was just being chatty and normal and wishing her happy birthday.
So was the spell broken?
Yeah. Ooh. That was what finally basically had her question the whole story. And
Years of it.
Like close to 6 years of an absolute unending ordeal. And like, I can't imagine how you come back to yourself after that.
Sure. Who are you at that point? All your formative years.
Yeah. Like ever begin to kind of be your own person.
Yeah.
Be vanished from their lives. But to date has never gone to prison for any of his crimes. At one point, they got him on some kind of, you know, when he'd hidden her in the convent, they did get him on something.
Kind of impersonating a police officer?
That was it. Exactly. God, yeah, well done. I couldn't remember. Impersonating a CIA officer.
That's it.
He spent...
After everything.
Are you ready? 15 days in prison.
Oh my God.
That was it.
Scum. Is insane.
And he was able to vanish. And so basically, Jan went on, grew up, became a like successful actress. She's been in tons of things. And she started in the early 2000s. Well, she had a baby quite young in her late 20s. She has talked a lot about how her romantic relationship's been completely blighted by this because she had been so impeccably effectively groomed that she couldn't match the love.
Nobody could make her feel that way again.
Yes. And so she started in her early 30s after she'd had her son kind of telling her story a little bit initially to just small groups of women, but she began to be like, this is my purpose.
Okay.
Because my story and our family story is the absolute quintessential example of grooming and manipulation.
Yep.
And how you can isolate each member of the family from the others.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And have total power.
What can we learn?
Yeah. And so then in the early 2000s, Marianne wrote a book called Stolen Innocence, all about the experiences. And she and Bob...
Marianne wrote the book.
Yeah, the mother. Sorry. Jan's mother. Jan's mother wrote this book. I think Jan herself has written another book. But this is where I think like it's admirable because like we can't imagine the suffocation of a community like that. And to come out and be like, this all happened and this is actually the role I played in it.
Yeah.
And especially for both of them, but Bob, like with the kind of homosexual element, which would have just been so unacceptable.
Yeah.
And he like spoke about it honestly and like
took full responsibility.
Yeah. They both did. And like,
do you know, it's actually just very hard to put yourself in the shoes of somebody who's been groomed and manipulated to that degree. It's very hard to imagine yourself becoming completely brainwashed by another human being.
It's easy happen. It happens so slowly.
By increments, you're just getting slowly and
it's so coercive. It happens like with these small little things over and over, and then years pass and you don't even realize.
Yeah. I just can't.
And also, like, I think B must have been like really charismatic.
No doubt.
You know what I mean? Like, I think as well, you have to put yourself in the mindset of having this incredibly sheltered life for Marianne and Bob, and what it must have been like to suddenly be like apparently the kind of target of this charismatic person's affections.
Yeah.
And like, he had a whole line to Marianne that it was like, oh, it was never about Jan, it was always about you. I mean, really fucked up. But basically, Jan, as well as her acting career, has like completely devoted her life to advocating for victims of grooming and child abuse. And has like, she's fucking amazing. She's like 60s, early 60s now. She and her son run the Jan Brogan not-for-profit that advocates for victims. She like has speaking engagements along with her mother Marianne, like all over the, you know, United States. She has a podcast herself.
Very good.
And like, she's just been so vocal. And now at this point, they've made two documentaries and one drama series about the story, all with the support of the Broberg family. And again, I do think that there is like redemption in the fact that the parents totally and utterly said this story needs to be told.
Amazing. You're
our
right.
part played in it has to be told.
And their family remained intact. Yeah. Amazingly.
Yeah. And the parents remain married. Bob passed away in 2018. And I mean, then when all of it started to gather media attention, B resurfaced out of nowhere.
Of course.
And tried to take them to court, claiming that
it wasn't accurate.
It wasn't accurate. Blah, blah, and the thing is, there is no easy speaking out. Jan and Marianne had to overcome huge backlash when they started telling their story.
Absolutely.
I wonder how Jan felt of lying. Reappearing after all that time.
She said that she felt ready to face him.
Mm.
And he said, I mean, there's a moment in court where he says something like, I'm just trying to protect my reputation with all these lies. I'm just trying to protect my reputation. And she says, well, I'm just trying to protect people from someone like you.
Yeah.
And he was then under investigation again. And at this point,
For her case?
For her case, but it also emerged that there was, so a lot of people didn't believe the alien narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Didn't believe he had made her believe that. And then that was when other people came forward and had the identical descriptions. And so he committed suicide. Before
Wonderful.
He could be held
what a coward.
To account for his actions. And it's just the kidnapped twice, maddest story. Maddest story.
It's a mad story.
Isn't
remember
it? Do you remember Abducted in Plain Sight?
Yeah.
So that was on Netflix a couple of years ago. And I remember watching it back then and being like, what? Every minute of that movie, you're like,
stunningly amazing.
And like, you know, like, I don't know why Bob really gets to me particularly. I'm
because
like,
he was,
because
he was, I mean.
But also, just I think it is brave. I think it is their atonement for their actions is being honest and just laying it all out there and being like, we were manipulated, but we obviously played a role here. And, you know, and then another documentary called Friend of the Family. And they made that into like a mini series, like a dramatized version. And again, like the whole family were in support of this, which is like huge. Mm. Because even if you had been public about these events, to have it made into a show, a TV show where all of their flaws can be laid bare, kind of
twisted around and made it worse in some ways.
Yeah.
Messages from their perspective
is getting
needs to be told.
Yeah.
This exactly, aware. Exactly.
And eyes open.
Yeah.
How, like you said, incrementally things can happen until suddenly.
Mm. And I think Jan Broberg's podcast is actually an amazing thing for anyone who has the residual shame of being abused as a child. Like, literally, I'm recommending it.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's an amazing piece of work. She's an amazing woman.
Amazing. Thank you.
Thank
Whoa,
you.
That's great. That was great. Thank you.
Thank you, Cass.
Thank you, Cass. And
thank you, dear listener.
We have so many things else over on the Hive. Should you wish for more? Maybe now's today's the day.
It's got to be about 300 back episodes.
Oh, there, it's crazy.
Including
crazy,
some absolute
crazy
classics.
Bangers over
crazy,
there.
Crazy, crazy girls. All such right,
as
love you.
None of which you can remember.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.